Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in political life. In this week's episode, I'm looking at the psychology of security. Wars have many implications, many legacies, and one of those is psychological. Given that, I want to look at the current conflict in Ukraine to explore ideas around security, its impact on Europe, how much, for example, of Putin's waging of war was influenced by thinking that Europe hadn't paid much attention to security, and how did the expansion of NATO play and continue to play into Putin's mindset. From Reaction, I'm Lucy Beresford, and for this episode of On the Couch, I'm delighted to say that my guest is Elizabeth Brough, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and columnist at Foreign Policy. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Let's kick off with events in the last couple of days, shall we? You know, with Finland and Sweden signing historic pacts with the UK to come to each other's aid should Russia attack. How much do you think those signings were about the military implications, and how much was around the psychology, given their close proximity to Russia?
These were really significant agreements that the UK signed with Sweden and Finland. And the immediate reason, or the urgent reason, for these agreements to be signed was that Sweden and Finland are about to apply for NATO membership. And the moment you apply for NATO membership, you cast your lot with the alliance. You essentially communicate to the world that this is the side we have chosen, but you don't yet enjoy the protection of the alliance because you're not a member until all the NATO parliaments have ratified your accession and essentially given you permission to join the alliance. So you have a very awkward wait. And in the current situation, it is to be expected that Russia will exploit that wait in some way to try to harm Sweden and Finland, precisely because for decades they have chosen not to join NATO because they made the calculation that it would be beneficial to them and maybe to regional security for them to remain outside the alliance. So it's a major political decision by these two countries that we can expect to see in the next few days. And precisely for this reason, somebody would do well to tell them and the world, if something were to happen, we'll help you. Nobody's under the obligation to do so, but it's a good deed to do. And the UK is a very close ally to Sweden and Finland, for example, through something called the Joint Expeditionary Force. So I think it felt called to provide these security guarantees. Sweden and Finland, of course, promised the same guarantees to the UK, but it's clear what this is about. It is the UK extending its military strength to Sweden and Finland.
And given all of your research on security, and in particular on the grey zone, as well as why I guess one might call the red zone of war, how much was Putin influenced then by this idea, for example, as identified by Trump, that Europe hadn't been taking security seriously, that perhaps there had been countries that hadn't been, as Trump would attest, putting enough money into NATO, and suddenly he then discovers that actually NATO has a bit more muscle. How much do you think he was influenced by that originally?
Russia is keenly aware of what goes on in other countries. They have fantastic military intelligence, in fact, fantastic intelligence, even though it didn't work out so well for them in Ukraine. Russian intelligence should have known that Ukrainians would stand up for their country. But nevertheless, this is no secret to anybody that a number of Western European countries in particular, and indeed Central and Eastern European countries, have been spending rather frugally on defense, and as a result are not particularly well set up to defend themselves or their allies. But another thing has been happening, Lucy, and that is that the gray zone has been offering many more opportunities than used to be the case in the past, simply because countries have been integrating financially, economically, culturally. So there are many more opportunities for a country wishing to harm other countries to do so in the gray zone. And that brings the advantage of plausible deniability, a limited cost in blood and treasure. So you don't even have to risk any of your soldiers' lives in order to significantly weaken another country, which is what Russia was doing so well with Ukraine up until the 24th of February, and has been doing well with other countries as well.
Well, this is the extraordinary thing, because you would have thought if he was doing so well in the grey zone in terms of destabilising other countries and making them feel insecure, which is fundamentally what bullies try to do, it's extraordinary then that he would then go into a military conflict. Now, obviously, that's in terms of territory, but this idea that he believed that NATO was expanding in his backyard, and even though obviously NATO categorically denied that this was the intention, why do you think he was the one that poked the stick? It's often been the West that's been criticized for poking the stick of the Russian bear, but why do you think he then decided to go and to go in February?
You're absolutely right, Lucy. Russia was doing so well in weakening Ukraine. And up until the 23rd of February, I thought the Russians were executing a brilliant strategy. They were positioning all these soldiers at the Ukrainian border, but not marching across, because the moment you march across, you are clearly the aggressor, but you are entitled to be on your side of the border. And yet, if you have all these soldiers at another country's border, you will frighten DI investors, you will frighten other investors, you will frighten insurers, who will then jack up the insurance rates or stop insuring, which is what happened with political risk insurers. So it became impossible to get political risk insurance in Ukraine, which in turn caused international companies to pull out. And of course, the risk of war made them also want to consider pulling out. So all this was happening. The Ukrainian economy was suffering terribly. And on top of that, Russia conducted naval exercises in the Black Sea, which of course got the attention of insurers, who said, oh, it's getting very dangerous to conduct shipping in the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov. And insurers raised the Ukrainian and Russian parts of the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov to the highest risk category, which made it very expensive, very difficult for shipping companies to sail in and out of those areas, which of course harmed Ukraine massively, because Ukraine has no other seaports. So if Russia had just kept going, it could have weakened the Ukrainian economy. It not just could, it would have weakened the Ukrainian economy massively, which is of course why up until the 24th of, or the evening of the 23rd of February, President Zelensky kept saying, oh, don't overreact, things are fine and we will handle it. And then, of course, the war came. And that, I think, is explained by the fact that this is not a rational operation by President Putin, not a rational decision by President Putin. It's not about the maximum cost-benefit equation he can get out of it, because if that were the case, he would have stuck with gray zone aggression, low cost, no lives lost, but it's about something emotional. And so he's willing to make massive sacrifices to achieve that emotional victory that he's after.
It's interesting you've used that word emotional, because it really brings me to my next point, really, which is at a very granular level, one might say at a very obvious level, the countries that border Russia have obviously been very affected emotionally by this war in a completely different way to, say, the UK. You know, we here in the UK, and I know you were here in London recently, we have tons of empathy for the refugees and we want to do all we can. But in many ways, we have needed to give no time at all to whether the UK will actually be next on Putin's invasion list. Our perception of threat is completely different. What do you think of that idea?
It really is true that the UK perception of threat is different, and the US perception of threat is very different altogether, even from the UK. But as you know, Lucy, I'm Swedish, and I remember, I'm a child of the Cold War, as I think many of us clearly are.
Yes.
And I remember vividly the daily reality of growing up during the Cold War. For example, we lived near, my family lived near an airbase, and every now and then, people would come and knock on our door, young people, now I think they were probably in their 20s, carrying paintings, and they said they were Polish art students. And I remember this vividly, because I even then, to me as a child, I thought it was odd that Polish art students would come all the way to Sweden, to this pretty remote town to sell paintings.
Gosh.
And then later, or even then, I guess it was known to the intelligence agencies, and later has become known to the public, that this was a sort of an intelligence documentation effort by by the Warsaw Pact to sort of document where various members of the armed forces lived, and because it was near an airfield. And we also had, of course, constant traffic by lorries from Poland in particular, and they would always stop. I remember this vividly too. They would always stop, make sort of breaks at various points near this airfield, and they were in transit. So why would they need to take such long breaks there? And once I remember my father stopped the car and walked up to a driver who was stopped, and there he saw him sitting with the radio. So all of this influences you, and it also influences you that, as was the case then, total defense was a huge thing. Lots of people were involved in national security on a voluntary basis as a hobby, really, because they felt they wanted to make that contribution to keeping the country safe. And of course, there was mandatory conscription for all men. So it was really a collective effort based on the fact that the threat was very real. And I remember also vividly the Whiskey on the Rocks incident when a Soviet nuclear submarine ran aground just, well, right by the Swedish coast in a military section of that coast. So it was daily reality in a way that the Cold War probably was not in the UK. I didn't grow up in the UK, but I think the further you are located geographically from Russia, the less threatened you feel. The situation felt less threatening in the UK, and of course, even less threatening in the US. And that brings us back to today, where Poles, for example, feel the pain of the Ukrainians much more vividly than we do in the UK, for example, or now I'm speaking from the US, than we do in the US, simply because for us in the UK or the US, it's a good humanitarian deed to help the Ukrainians, whereas for the Poles, it's the reality that they're lucky it's not them this time.
And that's a really interesting point you make about the daily reality, because at one and the same time, many people in countries like this, like the UK, as you say, where you are in the US, we don't have that daily fear, but we do have a daily implication of what this war is bringing about. For example, in terms of the cost of living crisis, which is partly being fueled, pardon the pun, by rising energy prices, partly contributed by the conflict in Ukraine, and also the rising costs of staples like wheat or sunflower oil. And I was wondering, because of some things you've talked about recently, what should governments do then to bring societies with them psychologically when a government wants to talk about the real cost of war? I mean, Britain has an army, and some of those members of those army might go to some of the border territories, but the rest of the nation doesn't necessarily have to think about whether they'll have to fight near Ukraine. But we do every day have to focus on the cost of living. How do governments deal with that?
I think we as the public in Western countries generally have been spending 31, 32 years in a sort of a state of blessed ignorance, where the private sector was constantly globalizing, and that meant an increasing availability of goods. I remember growing up, you could only get satsumas during certain months of the year, including the month when my birthday is. So it was sort of, I remember, yeah, that was something I associated with my birthday. Now you can get satsumas, any exotic fruit you can think of year round, and you can get any product, any good from anywhere in the world, because global shipping works so well, because companies are operating globally, either themselves or through their supply chains. And of course, globalization has also meant lower consumer prices. So we have all benefited massively from globalization. But what we are seeing today is that globalization can also be a weakness, because we are so dependent on other countries. Other countries can choose to exploit that, or Mother Nature can interfere, or we can be targeted indirectly by a war, which is what's happening now with consumer prices and the war in Ukraine. Russia isn't targeting us specifically or our fuel prices, but the result of the war in Ukraine is that energy prices are rising, food prices are rising. And that, I think, should bring home the realization to most people that you don't live in isolation from the rest of the world, even if you live in a very well-managed country such as the UK. And even if you live in a country that is able to look after itself militarily. The UK has phenomenal armed forces, but what are the armed forces going to do about grain prices? Nothing. And these are the new national security threats, right? Where the threat or the aggression or the crisis can be very damaging, but it has nothing to do with military aggression. So we are essentially defenseless against it.
Well, you've made the point before, actually, in another talk, that you can have a strong army all you like, but what is the point of having a strong army if the citizens are actually not behind you, if they kind of resent the expenditure or they resent the implications, as maybe, you know, the cost of living crisis might end up becoming? How does this influence government behaviour, do you think?
This is a challenge, especially for countries such as the UK, which has phenomenal armed forces. In fact, one could argue that the UK punches above its weight militarily because they have such phenomenal armed forces. But that, in combination with the fact that it's all professional armed forces, has led to a situation where the rest of the public doesn't really think about national security because they assume that, oh, well, we have the armed forces, they'll take care of it. Well, they'll take care of the military part, but it's not their specialty and it's not within their remit to look after other things. And yes, they can help in other contingencies, but that's not their job. And so it leads to the paradoxical situation that the military skills and defense and deterrence is really good. It's completely disconnected from the rest of society because most of us haven't served in the armed forces. Most of us may not even know anybody who is serving in the armed forces. So it's somehow a remote force that looks after us, but that we are not involved with and that we think can solve every problem. Well, it can't solve every problem. And of course, what we signal to countries such as Russia and China is that beyond our armed forces, we don't really have anything because we don't have a civil society that stands behind the armed forces and does its part, whether it's you or me as individual citizens, whether it's organizations, whether it's companies. We can't signal that to Russia or China or anybody else because we don't have it. So, of course, it makes sense then for those countries to try to target the rest of us, civil society, simply because we don't have the foggiest idea what to do in a crisis.
Exactly. And they are, as you say, looking to exploit that, sensing that there isn't that unity with the citizens in lockstep behind the army. We're very passionate about our armed forces, but whether we'd actually, you know, envisage conscription for everybody, that is clearly going to be off the table. Finally, in one of your books, The Defender's Dilemma, you explore what we've talked about before, this sort of grey zone, the non-military tools for aggression. And I was thinking, if you can't see the threat, if it's not a tank coming towards you down the lane, it's a cyber attack or it's disinformation. And I'm thinking now of not just Ukraine, who is kind of in the middle of a war, but what about those other countries, Moldova, what about the countries in the Baltic state? What is the impact psychologically on the defender, on the nation that is literally bracing itself for the next attack?
It depends on whether you have been preparing the public for it. If the public has not been told that there may be crises and there may be situations where you as a citizen have to be able to look after yourself and where you have to be able to look after others around you, if you haven't done that sort of education, conducted that education of the public will panic when a crisis occurs, which is, of course, what happened during COVID. The government had been, in the UK, had been very reluctant to communicate the risk of national crisis contingencies to the wider public because it didn't want to cause alarm. It didn't want people to panic. Well, there will be a crisis at some point, whether it's a pandemic or a gray zone attack of some kind, or indeed a war. And then it's too late to tell the public what to do. They will panic and it will be too late to do anything about it. So it seems obvious to me that the prudent path for governments is to have an honest conversation with the public, to tell them we have a phenomenal way of life, a phenomenal living standards here in our country, but it doesn't come for free. There will be disruptions. There will be other countries that will want to harm us. Mother Nature can strike again with another pandemic. So while we should enjoy this phenomenal way of life that we have, we also all have a role to play in keeping, helping keep the country safe, keeping protect the country if something were to happen. So as a result, the countries that I think are best prepared now are, in fact, for example, Estonia and Latvia, which have been focusing a lot on educating the public about cyber threats in the case of Estonia. And in Latvia, there is a new high school curriculum that teaches high schoolers, so teenagers, sixth formers, you might say, about national security and what to do if power goes out, what to do if Google Maps no longer works, things like that. So if something happens, they are at least empowered to look after themselves and their families. And I think that's something that we in Western Europe should look at as well. And Sweden and Finland are Sweden used to be very good at it. Finland is still very good at it. But it's something that I think empowers citizens to be able to withstand lots of crises. And if, you know, I think as a citizen, I would rather be empowered than helpless if a crisis strikes. So there is an enormous opportunity there, which is why I think the Baltic states are doing quite well at the moment, because their public, their citizens, their population isn't panicking in the way it would have done without this sort of regular conversation with the public about the threats to those countries.
Yes, because otherwise you're left to everybody making an individual assessment. And what we know here in the UK from Google Analytics is that people had been watching the news of events from Wuhan, events in Italy, the hospitals appearing to be overwhelmed, and had begun to make changes to their behaviour to the extent that actual commuting traffic in the 2 weeks before we had a lockdown was phenomenal, that actually it had completely fallen away as people took a personal decision to stay at home. But everybody was left thinking, am I doing the right thing? Because no one from the top is actually giving us that guidance. So what you're really saying then is, psychologically, what we need above all else, we can make personal choices because we're autonomous 21st century beings, but that only takes you so far, that when you're talking about national behavior, it actually has to be led from the top.
It has to absolutely be led from the top. There has to be an honest conversation with the public about the threats facing any given country. And that also allows a society to organize itself, to get that preparedness going as a collective effort. Because if you don't, if it's not a collective effort, you get sort of the prepper mentality, where some people go crazy, you know, thinking that a nuclear strike is now, you know, building nuclear bunkers for themselves with food until the end of times. Well, that's not what we want. That's not beneficial to anybody. We want everybody to be at least a critical mass of the citizenry, to be aware of the risks and to know what to do, but not to panic, not to overreact. And also, if we organize ourselves in that way, we make sure that we don't get the sort of run on the staples that we got in the early weeks of COVID, when everybody realized they needed to look after themselves and bought every last item on the supermarket shelves. That is clearly not beneficial either.
Exactly. A run on toilet rolls is never a good thing. Elizabeth Brough, thank you very much indeed for being such a wonderful guest on The Couch.
Thank you for having me.